Hello, Henry. How are you?
Not too bad, and yourself?
I can't complain. I'm not teaching yet, so things, I'm able to do very, very, very important work right now on international relations and zombies.
Okay, well, that's pretty good. I guess I've had my beginning of the semester haircut, which combined with the fact that it's damn cold here, means that it's going to be a blogging head's hat hair day. I'm afraid I've been trying to subdue my hair and not succeeding very well, so there you go.
Well, speaking of cold, we might as well segue into the first topic, which is the never-ending source of interest that is the country of Iceland. Last week, the Icelandic government, I think, had managed to secure passage through Parliament of a bailout proposal for the Icelandic government to assume debt for what were called, I think, Icesave accounts. There were savings accounts set up in the Netherlands and the UK. That earned higher than average interest, which is why a lot of British and Dutch individuals invested in them. However, once Iceland became insolvent and once the Icelandic banks became insolvent, all these savings went away. The British and the Dutch have placed significant amounts of pressure on Iceland to guarantee that it will repay these debts. The Icelandic government was not thrilled about this, but certainly went along with it. And then last week, the president of Iceland, for only the second time in Iceland's history, rejected a law approved by the parliament and the prime minister, and instead stated that it should go to a referendum. And this is a tremendously unpopular proposal. So I'm kind of curious what your take on this is first.
Well, I guess my initial take is I'm wondering whether we're going to get 65% of Iceland's population commenting in the thread to this, or whether we're only going to get 50%. But it's a pretty interesting story, I think, because there's a it's being depicted, I think, as a morality play in a lot of the media. You know, brave little Iceland standing up against the Netherlands and the United Kingdom. But I also think that it's pretty clear that there was beyond lax regulation happening within Iceland, and furthermore, the Icelandic government did give some guarantees. Effectively, what happened is that the British and the Dutch governments ended up bailing out a bunch of the depositors who had invested in these dubious savings accounts on the basis of a promise from the Icelandic government that they would then compensate the Dutch and the UK governments. And part of what seems to be happening here is that Iceland seems to be wriggling out, seeking to wriggle out of some of the more onerous obligations associated with this. So you could cast the blame either way. You could say that depositors should have known that when they were being offered these huge, these very significant increase in interest rates compared to what domestic institutions were prepared to offer, that they were taking some risk going along with that. You could also argue that the Icelandic government, under European free trade area law, had an obligation to seek to regulate these banks correctly. And really, what I think I don't think this is so much a morality play as a situation where basically either you're going to see the Dutch and the UK taxpayers getting landed with the unfortunate consequences of this, are you going to get the Icelandic taxpayers? And very clearly, they, Josef, as always, when there are billions of dollars at stake, people disagree profusely as to who should end up with the bill.
Yeah, I mean, I would add a few more things. First, I think in fairness, you have to defend the current Icelandic government. Part of, most of this mess happened with the previous Icelandic government. And I should point out that most of my expertise on this subject is based on the fact that I had to write a book review on a book called Why Iceland about 6 months ago in the Wall Street Journal, after which I heard from a whole bunch of Icelanders about what I got right and what I got wrong in the review. But one of the things that the book makes clear is that the Icelandic government, the party in power during the time of sort of the financial buildup, was truly and utterly incompetent. I mean, I don't think we can stress just how incompetent they were. The head of the central bank did not have training in finance. He was actually a poet. And to be fair, the sort of current government has been stuck with this mess and has tried to behave in a relatively honorable fashion. I think it's the president who I think took everyone by surprise. I agree with you that I'm not entirely sure this is a sort of, plucky little Iceland, resisting the pressures of the evil British and Dutch governments, in large part because, again, one of the things that came out very clear reading the book and reading a little more on Iceland is the Icelanders have a conspiracy complex that you would not believe, and they genuinely do think that the rest of the world really is out to get them. The thing that I think is really interesting about this is that there's a referendum now, and I believe it's been scheduled for early March. And the fascinating thing is that, you know, I think everyone's assuming, oh, no, this isn't going to go through, because it's true. Something like 25% of the population of Iceland signed a petition saying, please don't, you know, agree to this bailout. But I think actually, and, you know, one of this sort of points to one of the problems, which is this sort of current wave of economic populism that's swept not just Iceland, but, you know, an awful lot of the globe, you know, saying, damn the banks, damn the finances, you know, let's just, we shouldn't have to do this. But the funny thing is that I think the referendum actually might be illuminating. My hunch is the bailout goes through. And the reason is that because of the referendum, you're actually going to see ordinary Icelandic voters confronted with what the options are. The first one, passing the referendum, is not terribly popular. But the alternative, which is they're going to get cut off completely. If this referendum doesn't go through, they're going to get cut off from IMF access. Their financial system is basically going to be completely closed off from the rest of the world. There are really serious calamitous consequences if they don't pass this. And so as a result, it's very easy to sort of grump and you know, complain about what's being done. But I actually think the referendum might actually be useful in that it actually forces Icelandic voters to realize what the counterfactual is if they don't go through with the referendum.
I think, well, what's interesting to me about this, as somebody like you who studies international political economy, yeah, is that this really does pose in a very stark fashion the question about the relationship between the obligations of governments to regulate and the sort of popular sovereignty. We've seen a lot of control of regulation basically being hived off over the last 10 or 20 years. And this is something which really has passed outside of the realm of democratic policy or democratic policymaking in a certain sense, in that this is handled sort of typically on a very, very technical basis. And now the chickens, I think, are very much coming home to roost for Iceland. And it'll be very interesting, as you say, to see, because they're faced with, I think, an extremely unenviable choice in Iceland, whether or not, as you say, on the one hand, you vote for this and the figures are perhaps exaggerated, but certainly this is going to be a massive hit in that this debt is a sort of very substantial chunk indeed of Icelandic GDP, or else you vote against it. And as you say, you find yourself being cut off from the rest of the world financially, and Iceland, it's got what? It's got aluminium, it's got fishing, and that's basically about it. And its major markets are in the European Union, which is not going to be best pleased if two of the more significant member states find themselves sort of very sore as a result of that. And the third thing is sort of that this is being linked together with Iceland's proposed entry into the European Union. I think there has been a lot of speculation attached indeed to the current government, which has basically said, well, Iceland just can't hack it anymore in the same way as a small island on the edge of Europe. And it needs to be part of a larger bloc if it's going to succeed in protecting itself from some pretty chilly winds out there. And one final interesting comparison, I think, for me at least, I'm an Irish person, and Ireland similarly have gone through some pretty bad times. And the joke, indeed, in Ireland over the last year or so has been that the difference between Iceland and Ireland is one letter in 6 months. But Ireland, I think, it wasn't in quite as bad a situation as Iceland was, but it has sort of very definitely, it's going through with the haircut, and it's going through some very, very tough economic times as a result of some pretty substantial shrinking in government spending, unemployment is skyrocketing. It's in a very unpleasant place, but I think that despite the fact that there's very clear disgruntlement among the Irish population, I think the Irish population basically has accepted that it has very little choice but to go through with this and to deal with the bad times until perhaps the good times come around again.
I think you're right, though, that in some ways the sort of broader question that Iceland raises is the extent to which these sorts of questions about financial governance, financial regulation, even macroeconomic policy are you know, decided by a democratic or not democratic manner. And let me add, by the way, that I'm not necessarily endorsing the democratic manner over the non-democratic manner.
Yeah.
There's strong arguments to be made in favor of a technocratic process on this, you know, but on the other hand, it does raise legitimacy issues, which is if you have the technocrats actually screwing up, which God knows has happened, the problem is they don't have the sort of fallback of saying, well, everyone signed on to this, so, you know, don't blame us. And I think it really does lead to some sort of profound political questions.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that As you say, you could argue it either way, but I think that, for example, our colleague in Princeton, Andy Moravchik, argues very strongly in favor of technocratic governance of a whole sort of host of things in the European Union, which is, I think, one of the great examples of how technocratic governance can happen on the international level. But, you know, so when the bill comes due, as it very definitely has come due in Iceland, as it may be coming due in Spain and other countries within the European Union, this can raise some very, very serious and profound questions of legitimacy. And the interesting question, I think, is going to be, if you're incorrect and the Icelandic population decides basically to vote against this referendum, what happens then? What happens then for Iceland? What happens then for the way that the Icelandic government is treated in international relations by the IMF and by other multilateral bodies, by the European Union? It's going to be a very, very interesting, in the sense of the Chinese curse word of interesting, for period for international relations.
Yes, it's definitely chaos under heaven. Well, moving from Iceland to Europe in general, I think you wanted to talk about a sort of blog controversy about Europe vis-a-vis the United States.
Yeah, there's an interesting article. So this starts with an article that Jim Manzi wrote, which was basically a comparison of Europe and the U.S. and the sort of it was about the relationship between social democracy and free markets. And let me hasten to say I don't know Jim particularly well, but I do find him to be a pretty sincere, pretty nice guy. So whatever I say is meant as sort of friendly criticism rather than as destructive criticism. But effectively what Jim argued was something along the lines of, well, there are some very clear trade-offs here, which is that if you adopt the social democratic model, you're going to find yourself losing out on economic growth. And you're going to find yourself in a very, very tough, you're going to find yourself having to pay a real cost. And here the example that he drew on was Europe and how Europe had declined in terms of its share of world GDP over the last 20 or 30 odd years.
Right.
And so he basically ends up suggesting that some degree of that even despite this, some degree of social protection is appropriate, given that the opposite result that we get in the US is the level of inequality and economic inequality, which is frankly unsustainable. So I don't think that many people on the left would, they clearly would have disagreed with the emphasis of what he was arguing, but I think people would have would not have disagreed with the fundamental thrust of the argument, but it turned out that some of the figures he was using were tricky figures to use in this context. For example, when he defined Europe, at least this is according to Jonathan Chait, who then contacted him, the figures he used for Europe included figures for the for Russia, for the former Soviet Union, and so this really doesn't give a very good proxy of what happens in European social democracy for various very obvious reasons that social democracy, whether you like it or dislike it, is very different from state-sponsored communism. And so he came back and as did Ross Douthat, who had picked up on his piece in a column he wrote for the New York Times, and both of them came back and said, well, really, nonetheless, sort of the important thing is that the share has shrunk, and also that this sort of means that Europe it simply doesn't have the same kind of clout on the world economic stage as the United States has. It doesn't have the same kind of political clout. And then most recently, Paul Krugman...
That sound you hear, by the way, is Andy Moravchik screaming in Princeton, but go ahead.
Okay. And then Paul Krugman came back in the New York Times over the weekend and basically said that he'd looked at the figures, and even on the on Manzi's defense, they didn't seem to work. And his best guess is that Manzi had used one set of figures to describe what was happening at the beginning of the period that he was looking at, and one set of figures to describe, and a different set of figures to describe what was happening at the end, because the series basically did not match up. And so this, I think, as I say, I don't want to pile on Jim Manzi here, but I think it suggests that there's a couple of things that are interesting. So the most important thing, I think, being the ways in which Europe is used in U.S. policy debates. On the one hand, you get people on the right of the spectrum who include, I think, people like Jim, who basically see Europe as a shorthand for social democracy and for all the bad things that can happen in terms of economic growth and what have you that are associated with social democracy. And then you see people on the left side, and so they very often, I think, tend to see Europe as being France writ large. And then you see people on the left who likewise see Europe as a kind of proxy for social democracy, but see it instead as being Sweden writ large, you know, sort of the example of how social democracy can work out really nicely and very well. Whereas, in fact, Europe is a much weirder, more variegated place than any of these pundits really, I think, accept or realize. And I think there's a lot more fun and interesting things, you know, that you study when you look at Europe. European countries are dramatically different from each other in a way, for example, that states of the United States of America are not dramatically different for each other, and this counts.
So wait, I'm sorry, that last sentence I want to push you back on. So you're arguing that, in fact, the disparities in among European countries are much wider than the disparities among, let's say, U.S. states.
I think that's correct, okay. Yeah.
I mean, I would probably agree with you in the main, but I have to admit, this raises a bugaboo for me, which is, I mean, I agree with you. One of the things that I find is that sort of blog discussions that compare Europe and the United States, you're right, tend to be very slippery, in large part because it depends on how you define Europe. I've seen arguments where, you know, the sort of Europe will take over the world arguments where, you know, the commentators only look at Sweden, Germany, and France or only the really advanced northwestern European countries, and they ignore countries like Greece or, you know, Eastern Europe. But then by making the argument about Germany and Sweden, talk about Europe writ large. And I think that's problematic. In the same ways that when you talk about things like, let's say, income inequality in the United States, I'm not disputing that it doesn't occur, but a large source of that is, for example, immigration, which is an issue that, you know, affects the United States, and particularly certain particular U.S. states, more than it does Europe. So, I mean, there's always I always get a sense of apples and oranges comparisons for a lot of the time when people are trying to use Europe, and again, it's almost the distinction between Europe as opposed to the European Union, and then the United States. So I share your suspicion of how, you know, these numbers are used. But I mean, to ask a more general factual question, would it be safe to say, regardless of why this is taking place, it would be safe to say that if you take a look at, let's say, the sort of largest states in Western Europe, that their share of GDP, of global GDP, has been on the secular decline for decades. Would that be a safe statement?
I think that would be a safe statement.
Okay.
I would think it would. That there has been a significant amount of decline. The question being, I think, twofold. First of all, how substantial has the decline actually been?
Right.
Second question being, sort of, what political lessons should we actually
yes.
draw from this? And
yeah.
And this is maybe I'm sort of jumping ahead a little bit to the next topic we want to get at. But Cohen and Brad DeLong's book, which is a pretty interesting book on the United States, suggests that sort of one of the interesting things that maybe that economists are going to have to do over the next few years is to look at some of the GDP and productivity figures for the United States of America, which may have been grossly inflated by difficulties in measuring the actual sort of contribution that finance makes to the economy. So.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I tend to agree that the reasons for why Europe is declining, I think Matt Iglesias posted something about this that suggested it's not that Europe has become less productive, it's just that Europeans don't work nearly as much as Americans. I think there's a large grain of truth to that. But I think there's a different lesson to draw for us IPE types than there is for economics types. Which is, for economics types, they can debate the sort of relative merits of the sort of social democratic system versus the somewhat more laissez-faire system in the United States. From an IPE perspective, though, I do think that aggregate output is actually the thing to care about. And you can argue that you know, the Europeans, for whatever reason, because of demographic issues and because of, you know, the choice of greater leisure over greater output, are shrinking and therefore are somewhat less powerful. Now, you can argue that maybe it would be best if everyone lived that way, but I think in some ways it's almost like a Fukuyama end of history thing where you can argue the Europeans are now sort of in the post-historical epoch, but the United States and, oh, by the way, the rest of the world still is operating in history, and therefore things like market size really do matter.
Well, here, I guess, it's got to a basic, not a fundamentalist agreement between us, but maybe I think you have a very significant difference of emphasis, at least, which is, I think, so I buy your argument completely when it comes to stuff like military ability to project force and stuff like that, where clearly Europe is dramatically less able to do things than it used to be.
Yeah.
But when it gets to the realm of international political economy, I think market size is something which is very important, but I think it's market size as accompanied by ability to leverage that market size through appropriate regulations. And here I think Europe has played an extremely canny game in actually in sort of managing to hit above its weight, I think, in a certain sense, because it's being prepared in ways that the US has not in some very important areas of market regulation to effectively use its regulatory powers and its regulatory strengths in order to impose, for example, product standards and stuff like that on other countries. Whereas the U.S., in contrast, because the U.S. has had this some sort of internal system which is based around free markets and whatever, has had much greater difficulty very often in actually coordinating a response, and therefore I think tends to punch somewhat below its weight when it comes to very important issues of market regulation.
And this is work that you've done, and I think David Bach and Abe Newman have done as well. I think there's a valid point to be made. I think what's interesting down the road, however, is going to be whether or not the EU is still going to be able to punch above its weight, because you can argue that market size is shifting. It's not just the U.S. now that is actually going to care about this stuff. It's also countries like China and India. I think the other question is how long the European Union in particular can continue to play this double game. I agree with you that I think in some ways the EU has gotten the best of both worlds in a lot of these regulatory arenas, because on the one hand, it's, what are we up to, 28 countries now?
I've lost count.
I think it's 28 countries. On the one hand, in a lot of these standard-setting bodies and organizations, they represent 28 different countries. But then there are times where they can act as a single unified market. And as a single unified market, the EU is still larger than the United States. And so I agree that they can absolutely, play that game relatively well. I am kind of curious over the long term whether they're still going to be able to do that. And I think this is still an open question. I had a go-around with Gideon Rachman back in the fall where Gideon argued that the G20 was the sort of EU-ization of global governance, because they were the ones most comfortable with all these, sort of regulatory promulgations. Whereas I'm not entirely sure that's true, that in fact European power, relatively speaking, got diluted in the shift from the G8 to the G20. But I genuinely think this is an open debate. I think it'll be interesting down the road to see whether or not this actually holds up. But I think we wanted to...
perfect segue into the next, topic, which is the rising role of China and of countries which are quite different from the EU and from the US. And here I think Stephen Cohen and Brad DeLong's very, very interesting book has some interesting things to say.
With Stephen Cohen, yeah. I've only had a chance to take a quick look at it. Do you want to provide a nice précis of what his argument is?
Okay, well, very, very briefly, I think it's as follows. So Cohen and DeLong, they start from the same place a lot of macroeconomists start from, which is talking about the fundamental imbalances in the relationship between the U.S. and the rest of the world, the U.S. as the kind of consumer of last resort, and in particular in the U.S.-Chinese relationship, where effectively what we see is the U.S. sort of being pretty profligate, borrowing left, right, and center in order to finance its consumption patterns, and China effectively engaging in a kind of forced saving in order to lend money to the U.S. so that the U.S. can continue to buy Chinese products. Here I simplify, but this is a story of imbalances and of a kind of tricky and awkward relationship, which a lot of people have been talking about for a number of years, and where a lot of people have said we need to have some sort of soft landing, where the U.S. gradually becomes a little less willing to spend freely, a little more willing to save, and where the very awkward mutual dependency that has developed between the U.S. and China here can actually be unraveled over time.
Right.
And this is, I think, a pretty standard story. I think that Cohen and DeLong do a nice job in telling it. But what I think is interesting is that much more than most economists, and Brad DeLong at least is a macroeconomist, they're very sensitive to the political consequences that this has, and in particular to the way that the neoliberal order that has characterized the world for the last 20-odd years has been based upon some fundamental political assumptions, and in particular the preferences of the United States. And I think their argument is pretty straightforward. First of all, the people are going to pay less and less attention to what the U.S. actually wants over the coming decades. Mm-hmm. This is not a situation where the U.S. is going to suffer a massive collapse in power, but it's going to its go-it-alone power, to use Lloyd Gruber's term,
yep,
is going to be very, very significantly less than it used to be. It's going mm-hmm. to have to consult. It's going to have to deal with the fact that China and other countries actually, even if they don't have what you might call a veto power here, because they're going to suffer as much from a dramatic fall in the price of the dollar as everybody yeah. else does, they at least have to be consulted and they have to be part of the process. And
well, it would be safe to say they don't have veto power over the end of the dollar, but they have veto power over a lot more issues than they used to 2 years ago, for example.
That's exactly right. So this is not like a so basically what Conan DeLong are doing here. This is not a Paul Kennedy type of book about more or less collapse. This is a book about gradual decline of the U.S. in relative terms and mm-hmm. how the U.S. ought to deal with it. And the second part of this is that they argue that this means that the assumptions of the neoliberal order, which are effectively centered on states not getting involved in industrial policy and whatever, yeah. that these are likely to wither away as well. That we're going to see, for example, sovereign wealth funds engaging much more in proactive efforts to engage in industrial policy. Here, mm-hmm. for example, they differ from people who argue that this is all going to be about the Russians or the Saudi Arabians or whoever stealing our companies and seeking to undermine us by stealth. Instead, they argue that this is about innovation and about the ways in which patterns of innovation can be reshaped by governments which seek, for better or for worse, to relocate innovation in ways that secures their long-term economic advantage. And they also talk about the ways in which the economic collapse or at least the substantial decline of the last year or so is likely to further this because of governments having had to buy up lemon companies of one sort or another.
And right, once lemon socialism. Yeah.
Have this, they engage in what Conan DeLong referred to, I think this is their own coinage, lemon socialism, which means that they have these companies and they're likely to start to use these companies as a means to actually engage in industrial policy of one sort or the other. So really what they're saying is America is going to have to deal with the fact that it can't unilaterally set the rules of the game anymore, and the rules of the game are going to be much more friendly to countries basically getting involved directly in the economy, to seeking to direct economic growth and innovation in certain directions, and that the U.S. may not like this very much, but it's not going to have very much choice about it either.
No, that roughly jives with what I read. I mean, my take on this is that, I mean, I respect DeLong and Cohen a fair amount, and so I think this is certainly an argument that needs to be seriously considered. I think I'm a little more optimistic, actually, than they are, for a couple of reasons. First, I don't think sovereign wealth funds are going to quite be as significant as they argue in this book. Correct me if I'm wrong, I think they actually even acknowledge in the book that the sort of transparency initiative to make sovereign wealth funds more open in terms of the sort of IMF process, and this is something that I deal with in an article in International Security that came out in the fall, I think DeLong and Cohen actually acknowledge that this has gotten a lot more traction than they really anticipated. And I think one of the things that it highlights, actually, is one of the oddities of this thing, is that originally sovereign wealth funds were talked about, for example, as an example of how authoritarian governments can, develop resources as a way to sort of sustain their regime in power. But what's fascinating is the Transparency Initiative is actually forcing a lot of these governments to have to acknowledge to their citizens how exactly they're investing this money. So as a result, countries like China have had to deal with the fact that a lot of the sovereign wealth fund investment hasn't necessarily gone as well as they had originally anticipated. Now, it's possible that these funds are going to morph into sort of domestic development banks. But here, I'm going to fall back a little bit on my sort of faith in how markets work and, recycle a line that I think Ken Rogoff used a couple of years ago, which is governments have a very long and distinguished history whenever they enter sort of the private market of investing and then losing massive sums of money. So I'm relatively skeptical about the ability of these sorts of, development approaches to work terribly well. They might work a little bit. I don't mean to say that, you know, that they're all going to be miserable failures. But I don't necessarily think they're going to lead to the sort of robust rates of growth that I think some people are concerned with. And as a result, it's possible that this model is going to lose a lot of its luster before, you know, China really does overtake the United States in terms of things like economic power. And this leads to a second problem, which is not I don't think DeLong and Cohen explicitly make this mistake, but I think implicitly they do, which is that, you know, it goes back to, I don't know if you saw this Pew survey last month that showed a majority of Americans now believing that China is the most important economic power in the world. And, you know, there's just no way to say this gracefully. That's just so wrong that you can't believe how wrong it is. If you use any sort of metric, with the exception of currency reserves, if you use any other metric of sort of economic power, the United States still dwarfs China. Now, the trajectory is such that China might catch up with the United States, and some of these other BRIC economies, you know, will slowly catch up to the United States. But it's going to take at least a decade, if not more so, for that to happen, unless there's another crisis. And I think part of the problem with books like DeLong and Cohen's is that they're sort of anticipating the fall before it actually happens. I don't disagree with the assessment that as U.S. power weakens, relatively speaking, the U.S. is going to have to learn to cooperate with others. But it's going to take a little time for U.S. power to weaken as much as I think Cohen and DeLong thinks it's going to.
Okay. Well, I'm actually going to be with Cohen and DeLong here. And okay. let me make clear, you know, so I think that they're both I'm definitely to the left of you, so I'm much less worried in principle about state intervention in the economy. But let me be clear as well that I think that there could be some very significant disadvantages as well as advantages to this. But first of all, I think this gets back to the Iceland question in an interesting way, which is it's all about the relationship between popular sovereignty and what it is that governments actually do. And it may well be, as you say, that when citizens realize that governments are effectively wasting their money, that they're going to demand that the government actually engage in fiscal appropriate frugal management, you know, so that they seek good investments and all of these good things. It may equally be that they seek to have the government invest in various pie in the sky projects, which are politically popular for one reason or another. And I'm very skeptical, for example, that is going to be possible, for example, for governments easily to follow the example of countries like Norway, where Norway very definitely has sought effectively to sterilize the negative downside of having all of this resource wealth by using this fund in a very, very careful way of seeking to disperse all the goodies for political reasons, as you might expect to happen, and has thus avoided a lot of what happened to Holland back in the day when Holland suffered the so-called Dutch disease. This requires, in order to understand why that's an appropriate policy, you've got to have a pretty sophisticated understanding of international macroeconomics, currency flows, relationship between imports, exports, and so on. Yeah. And that's something which I think is going to be extremely difficult for policymakers, whether in authoritarian regimes or in democratic regimes, to explain to their people. I think Norway is presumably a happy exception here. But I think fundamentally, what this comes down to is, I think you're more confident than I am that this is really about markets. In the end of the day, the logic of the market is going to reassert itself as people realize that if you behave in certain ways, that this is economically self-destructive. I believe that, for better or for worse, that politics are the underlying thing here, and that whether or not this is a good or a bad thing, and certainly you can make arguments that increased state involvement in the economy can be a very good thing under certain circumstances. Danny Roderick, for example, I think gives a very good account of social democracy and industrial policy along these lines. Whether or not you think it's a good or a bad thing, I think that the politics are going to reign supreme over markets rather than vice versa.
That's an interesting argument. And I agree that it's one that I think we're going to have to see in the coming months. I think the Iceland referendum is really in some ways an interesting test, because I think you're right. My basic thesis is that once voters are actually confronted with what the market outcomes are of that vote, they're probably going to vote in favor of the referendum. But you're right. I mean, if I had to put money on this, I'm not sure how much money I'd want to put on that bet. And so I agree with you that the potential is that there's this gap between sort of technocratic explanations for why these policies are being pursued and then how well you can explain them to citizens. And, you know, and you're right, China is another example where there's a tremendous amount of resentment among the Chinese about why the China seems to be buying up U.S. debt when China's the country that's, you know, much, much poorer than the United States. And the Chinese government seems incapable of explaining why it's doing this, even though there's actually not the best logic, but there is a logic to why they're doing what they're doing. So I agree with you. I think in some ways this comes full circle and goes back to the point of to what extent can we think of you know, citizens in both democratic and authoritarian countries understanding the sort of ways in which not just financial markets work, but the ways in which they want them to work. And whether the ways in which they want them to work are actually possible.
Okay, well, may you live in interesting times, and certainly for international political economy scholars like yourself and myself, this is interesting times.
This is awesome for us, unfortunately. Yeah. But I think we've nicely gone full circle, so this is probably a best a good time to sign off.
Okay, that sounds good. We were going to talk about the New York Times and the craziness of some of the recent editorials. Should we just leave that for next time?
Yeah, we can leave that for next time. Unfortunately, I need to get going, so I don't think we have enough time to chat about that.
Okay.
That sets us up for a Blogging Head sequel.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, take care, Henry.
Okay, bye.
Bye.